This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me. Right now, you like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I'm Katie Ritchie, the deputy editor of VanityFair.com, and I'm here with our whole crew. We have our digital director, Mike Hogan.
Hey, Katie.
Our chief critic, Richard Lawson.
Hello.
And our senior writer, Joanna Robinson.
Hi, Katie.
It is December. We are in the busiest time of year for awards of all kinds. Possibly as we're speaking, the National Board of Review is releasing their list of winners for this year, which we probably won't get to talk about unless it literally breaks while we're recording, which would be fun and exciting. But the Gotham Awards happened in New York. The Indie Spirit nominations are out. The Critics Awards are going to start coming really fast. The Golden Globes are less than a week away as we record. So there is a lot happening. And on top of all of that, everyone is spending 3.5 hours watching Netflix to catch up with the new Martin Scorsese movie. So we have all of those things to talk about, which is exciting. But we wanted to kick off with the Gotham Awards because we're recording this on Tuesday. They happened last night. Richard, you were there in the room at a very fancy table, I understand. You were kind of a VIP this time.
I was invited by Gunpowder and Sky to sit at the Hearst-Mel table because the star of that movie and one of the stars of this podcast, at least for one episode, Elizabeth Moss, was nominated at the Gotham. She did not win, sadly. She actually was kind of a surprise win in that category for Best Actress. Went to Awkwafina for The Farewell.
Who was expected to win? Scarlett Johansson?
I don't know who was expected to win exactly, but I don't think I would have pegged that as the outcome, certainly. But yeah, I think the big narrative really for our sort of predictive purposes is how well Marriage Story did. It won Best Feature, Best Actor, and Best Screenplay for Noah Baumbach. And I don't know. I mean, if you look at who does the nominating for the Gotham Awards, it's a bunch of people, you know, we all know, kind of journalists, film people, critics, whatnot. But then the people who vote on the actual winners is an interesting combination of film people, be they actors, directors, writers, and otherwise in the industry. And so, I don't know, that would seem to, it's a small amount of people compared to the Academy, of course, but it would seem to indicate some, you know, strong institutional support for Marriage Story.
Yeah, I was talking to Mike before this, who was kind of asking about what qualifies for the Gothams and what doesn't. And I tried to get a little bit of intel. It's kind of like the Indie Spirits, where it needs to be an independent film. It needs to be under some budget number. I don't know that it has a specific one. And it has to be American. So That disqualifies everything from Parasite to The Irishman. Even though Marriage Story is a Netflix movie, The Irishman cost a fortune and Marriage Story didn't. So it's a smaller selection of the movies in contention. But I think you're right, Richard, that it does indicate a lot of strength for Marriage Story.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good way to start its narrative, at least, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, when you look at the nominated films, it's The Farewell, Hustlers, Marriage Story, Uncut Gems, and Waves. So not a lot of that group, I guess, probably Marriage Story is the only, like, Best Picture possibility to win, you know.
Yeah.
I think you could imagine maybe one or two of those others getting in for a nomination. But man, yeah, they won how many awards last night? I mean, it was like...
I think they won those three big ones, and then there was an audience award.
Right.
So, yeah, it was just that you just heard, like, the whole dinner... While the show was happening, I was like, "Has Noah Baumbach just been standing on that stage for 2 hours?"
Right,
like that's
he
what
was
it
the
felt
host,
like.
Actually,
yeah. It's so interesting because, you know, now that The Irishman is out on Netflix, the big conversation on social media is happening around it. You know, there's a kind of a small film Twitter conversation around these things, and then the rest of the world gets to see it. And so I think it's next Friday, right? That that Marriage Story
I think that's
comes
right,
out.
Yeah.
So I'm really interested to see how humans in the wild react to it.
Yeah,
because I loved it. I thought it was great. Obviously, a lot of people liked it as well.
I
I loved it, and I think it has... I'm going to use the success of Knives Out in the theaters this past weekend as a benchmark for what can happen when you put incredibly popular franchise actors like Chris Evans in a... I'm not going to, like, pin it all on Chris Evans, but, like, Knives Out performed super well. The only thing I can think of that, like, maybe got people in seats, other than Rian Johnson's willingness to talk to everyone about this movie, which I am so impressed with his publicity tour for that.
Including Little Bull, like, Men, if you haven't heard last week's episode.
Including this podcast. But, like, you know, he's done, like, so many Q&As. He talked to Anthony Breznican for a screening last week. Like, he's just been around. But also, like, Chris Evans in that trailer, I think, was such, like, a huge draw for people. And, like, people, I mean, ScarJo, Adam Driver, Laura Dern, like, these are hugely popular actors.
Alan Alda.
Alan effing Alda. I just meant, like, populist popular.
Yes, yes.
Maybe Alan Alda is hip with the youths. Maybe the TikTokers love MASH. I don't know. But
that would be really great.
But that would be great. But yeah, so, like, I think a bunch of people are gonna see it. Like, people love Adam Driver and everyone else that's involved. And I think it's just I'm really excited for him to see it. I love this movie.
But on the other hand, I mean, yes, people love all these actors, but on the other hand, it's an incredibly fairly excruciating, you know, dive into divorce, which is, and I think it does so entertainingly. And, you know, as someone who's been through a divorce, like, it's, I think it's very legit how it handles it. But it's not the, like, most fun topic. I mean, Knives Out at the end of the day is, like, basically Clue with an all-star cast. And this is a pretty dark, intense thing. But so is The Irishman. And lots of people liked it and are talking about it. And some people didn't like it. And that's turned into a fun kind of debate.
Yeah,
and I think it's less excruciating than The Irishman, which we can get into. Sorry, Richard.
I agree.
No, I was just going to say that, like, if you are someone who, you know, is kind of passingly aware of what movies are being spoken about as awardsy, but, you know, you're sort of a casual observer of that, like, Marriage Story offers a lot of access points that, like, maybe something a little bit more esoteric that's also in the awards conversation doesn't. And so I feel like it's a good access point for people who want to at least have something to talk about at Christmas parties, you know, in the coming Saturdays, you know.
So what are the meme gifts going to be? Is it going to be Adam Driver punching a hole through the wall?
Laura Dern giving a monologue about, like, the Virgin Mary or whatever. Yeah, she also won a special tribute award at the Gothams this week. And, like, Greta and Gerwig and Noah Baumbach, who both have her in movies this season, like, introduced her. They gave kind of a long thing. And, like, that further bolstered the movie's profile, not just Marriage Story, but Little Women, too. But, yeah, I don't know. It just feels like zeitgeisty enough for a kind of small, somewhat devastating divorce drama.
What's funny about Laura Dern in those two films, too, the husband and wife directors, and they couldn't be more different, the two roles.
Yeah.
It's really, that's like, I mean, you know that Laura Dern is a great actress with lots of range, but it's fun to see her in these two side-by-side kind of performances.
Yeah, and you know, it furthers the narrative that, you know, Gold Derby and many others are kind of, you know, perpetuating at the moment that she's the favorite to win supporting actress.
Yeah.
So.
Well, yeah, Joanna, you talk about Rian Johnson talking to everybody. Laura Dern is like a time traveler. Like, she is everywhere. Every time you turn around, she's accepting a, like, special award somewhere.
I mean, Richard and I both have been in the presence of Laura Dern accepting a special award this season, and, like, that's alone. And I think she has like a whole mantle full of, you know, because, like, Vulture gave her one. Like, she's got a ton of honorary awards this season that she's just, like, got this whole narrative. And that's why, I mean, we don't need to reopen this case right now, but, like, I keep seeing the more and more award screeners I watch, the less I'm convinced that the Best Actress category is sewn up. We can revisit that in another time, but, like, I don't feel that cemented the same way I feel Laura Dern and Adam Driver cemented. So.
Well, Anna Paquin's now in the lead, right, for Best Actress?
The only performance that matters in The Irishman, according
to the most supportive actress?
Most supportive.
Richard, from being in the room at the Gothams, did anyone stand out as, like, especially exciting? Like, was everyone centering on everyone? I saw A-Rod showed up, so his Oscar buzz is definitely increasing.
Yeah, A-Rod was there, which means Jennifer Lopez was there. And I didn't realize that they get a lot of talent. I mean, like, Sandler was there, like, Jennifer Lopez was there. It felt like a very lively, star-studded room. And, you know, I don't know. I think that, like, the Hustlers having such a strong presence there, even though it didn't really win anything, like, it was nominated for things, and, like, the whole cast was there. I got to thank Kiki Palmer for Sorry to This Man in person, which was
thank you.
Pretty
thank
exciting. You for doing that. And I also met Constance Wu, and she was very lovely. So, you know,
Now, the only time
don't believe the rumors.
The only time I went was the year of Lincoln, that crazy year when I sort of did like the full circuit, every single thing. And Daniel Day-Lewis, like, you know, was there. Like, so you're just like, okay, I guess they all come. If he's here, they're all coming.
When they're, it's New York City, it's easy to get to for most, you know. And it's nice free dinner. I sat next to Agnes Dayne, who was also in Her Smell. And like, we were both talking about like the food was like weirdly like kind of good. It like wasn't like wedding food you would think of like at an event like that. So they make it a very nice evening in order, I think, to help get all the talent there. I just saw a ton of people like networking, and it was a whole, I think I would say, honestly, the most popular person in this vast room at Cipriani Wall Street was Noah Jupe, who was nominated for his supporting turn in Honey Boy and is also in Ford v. Ferrari. He's, I don't know, 14 or something. And like, I just saw like everyone saying hi to him.
Well, I hear they're going to remake all of Shia LaBeouf's movies with him in them.
Live action remakes of Shia LaBeouf's movies.
So I watched Ford versus Ferrari last night. Really liked it. Also Her Smell last night. And
Wow, big night.
Thanks.
Those are not short movies.
No. Noah Jupe is so good in Ford versus Ferrari, which is what Richard said a couple weeks ago when we were talking about it. And then I Googled him and I saw he has like an earring in real life. Was he wearing his earring?
He was. He was not wearing his dangly earring that he wore, I believe, on Ellen. Okay. But he was wearing a different kind of earring and a very smart suit. It's just kind of funny when you just like see a 14-year-old who's like 18,000 times cooler than you. And you're just like, well, then who cares? What's the point trying?
Yeah, I really need to figure out my rule on kids at award shows for Noah Jupe, because he's 14. He's going to be 15 in February. Like, he's kind of old enough to have fun at these things. I need to get back on this, because I think he's so great in these movies, and I want success for him. But I also want him to be a kid, which is the plot of Honey Boy, which is part of why Honey Boy's great.
Mm-hmm.
I hear he texts with Drake a lot all night.
God. He's too famous. Well, speaking of award shows that happen in New York, the next big one will be the National Board of Review, which, like I said, they're about to announce their nominees, but also the New York Film Critics Circle Awards, which always happen right after New Year's. And Richard, you're in the Critics Circle. You're going to be voting tomorrow, so you don't know what's going to win, although by the time people hear this, they will. Do you want to just like give it insight into like what you expect to happen, what your plans, what you're going to stump for?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's an interesting year for us because we don't always vote on these lines, but like there are a lot of New York-y movies this year between Marriage Story, Uncut Gems, The Irishman to some extent is at least an East Coast movie, if not specifically New York. But Scorsese certainly is a very much a New York director. So that it'll be interesting to see if those things affect the outcome. You know, I saw Uncut Gems kind of like later. I saw it like maybe I think last week before Thanksgiving. Had missed it at all the fall festivals, and I was so taken by it. I mean, it's on my top 10 list, which, you know, I was surprised because I did not like the Safdie brothers' previous two films.
Yeah, you had kind of actively avoided Uncut Gems.
Because everyone was like, it's so stressful and you're going to be miserable. And I get what they were saying, but like, it's good stress because it's just such a well-made movie.
Yeah.
And I think Sandler is terrific in it. So I'm gonna vote for him for actor, which I did not think I was going to do as recently as, you know, a week and a half ago. But I just think that would be kind of a cool win. I think that, you know, in years past, like, the New York Film Critics Circle has been, I think, good about giving awards to performers who don't typically win awards. Like Cameron Diaz won for There's Something About Mary. We gave a prize to Tiffany Haddish for Girls Trip and Regina Hall for Support the Girls. And so, I don't know, I think Sandler would be a part of that narrative as well, as would Jennifer Lopez.
Yeah. She's the
another New Yorker. So
classic New Yorker. I feel like she's the one who's might get the biggest boost out of there. And I'm also very curious to see what you guys go for Best Actress, because as Joanna was saying, like, Renee Zellweger is kind of the minted front runner, but I wouldn't expect her to be a critical one. But I don't really know who would win instead.
Elizabeth Moss.
Yeah, I mean, Elizabeth Moss would be great. That, again, is another kind of New York-y movie because Alex Ross Perry is a dyed-in-the-wool New Yorker. It was filmed in this area, so that could help things. One name I heard tossed out, just kind of casually talking with other members at the Gotham Awards cocktail thing this week, was Jesse Buckley for Wild Rose, which is, if you're flying Delta in the next month or two, it's on there. Go watch it. It's really good. It's a nice, plain movie. Don't follow it up with the Beatles movie yesterday because then you're going to be disappointed. But anyway, I don't know. There's some interesting names thrown about. I don't think Renee Zellweger will be one of them. I'm sure she'll get a few votes, but like, it just doesn't feel like a very us kind of thing to do. So yeah, I mean, maybe Elizabeth Moss. Like, I think there's a lot of support for her, especially among some of the younger, quote unquote, younger members of the group who I've spoken to.
Are you a younger
Aquafina, like Gotham Awards?
I mean, Awkwafina could be, yeah, I think that that name could definitely be in the mix, as could Scarlett Johansson. You know, I think there are a lot of people love Marriage Story, and I think a lot of members of the critic circle, they vote differently from each other. I think that I tend to vote a little more strategically. You know, if there's like a number two, my second favorite performer of the year, I'm not going to vote for them because I don't want to give the competition votes. You know, like I want my number one to win. But a lot of people vote more on sort of principle. And so I think Marriage Story is like, you're like, I know it has this issue or whatever. It's obvious, but I love it so much. I'm going to vote for it. I can kind of see that happening for that movie.
Huh.
I don't want to knock Renee Zellweger because, you know, I've watched Judy. I think she's doing like everything in that movie. I'm so glad that she has this like big role this year. But yeah, after I watched her Smell last night and thinking about Wild Rose, I was like, Renee's performance is my third favorite troubled female musician performance of the year. And so like, I don't know, like if that's, I'm really hyped for this Elizabeth Moss train to get out of the station and start going. And I think Critics Awards are exactly where that momentum can start to build for her. So
yeah, sure. I feel like I've been saying for months, like if she won New York Film Critics Circle or a major Critics Award, like that could turn into a dark horse awards campaign. Although I don't know that it's as well funded as a lot of the other ones are, but yeah, you guys have the power, Richard. Although Joanna, we have a critics group too. So we have power too.
Yeah, we do.
Ours is a little bit harder to wrangle because it is much larger. We vote in the Critics' Choice Awards, and our nominations happens all via email, so no one's like sitting in a room and haggling the way they do at the New York Film Critics Circle Awards. But how's your strategizing going, Joanna?
Well, my bribes are out to you and a few other people, okay, so I hope we're all going to like vote in a block together. Yep. No, I'm just desperately trying to like get everything in so I can make an informed choice by Friday. But we were talking about this, and not to sound too like privileged on this award season podcast that we have for Vanity Fair, but there are a couple movies we haven't gotten yet, and I'm a little frustrated because how am I supposed to, we're voting on Friday, how am I supposed to vote if I haven't seen like all of the films? So if you're listening, award screener people, it's not too late to overnight meet Cats or whatever.
You're saying about strategy, Richard, I feel a lot in the nominations process. Like I've been trying to figure out like, do I want to put Two Popes in there? Cause I like that movie, but I don't necessarily love it as much as some other things, but like, I would like Jonathan Pryce to get in there. So like, should I put him on there and not Adam Driver, even though I think Adam Driver is great. And I don't know how much power I have in a group this large, but it does, it maybe gives you some insight into how people vote for the Oscars too.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that from the few Academy members I've actually who spoken to who like will tell me like how they vote, I think that there are a lot of them are like a lot more strategic than we think. You know, like there is a kind of there's a technique to it almost that I don't know. It's probably impossible to take into full consideration because we don't know the inner thoughts of these people. But I don't know. It's an interesting kind of thing to think about as more of these things come out. Is that like it's not just always my favorite thing is blank. There's a lot other things at work.
Don't you think the Academy probably spends a fair amount of time thinking, is this good for the Academy?
Oh, sure.
Is this good for the Oscars? And then they kind of get grandiose. It's like, is this good for America?
Are we honoring the country by honoring the film? Yeah.
Yeah.
No, totally. And I think, you know, look, I think the New York Film Critics Circle does that too. You know, I at least I'll speak for myself. Like, I've only been in the group, I think this will be my fourth vote with them. But I found myself saying out loud to other members, I just don't think that's a very us movie, you know, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so you want to preserve some imagined, you know, sanctity or what legacy or something. But yeah, and then with the Academy, which is much more storied in its way, I would think absolutely we can't vote for that.
Right, yeah. Right.
When I feel like Hustlers could be in, have a trouble with that, you know.
Yeah, I think so. Right, yeah. Exactly. Because it's sort of like, it's a stripper movie. Like, yeah. Are we really?
It's fun, but
yes, yeah.
That's mm-hmm. so frustrating. It is so good.
But whereas for the critics, Hustlers is exactly the kind of thing. Like, you know, even Support the Girls last year is maybe the closest comparison. Being like, yeah, we're going to stick our necks out for this.
Yeah, my fearless forecast is I would be very surprised if I leave that room at Lincoln Center and J-Lo has not won. I think that's going to happen, but we'll
that is interesting because that's critics basically saying like almost saying to the Academy, don't dismiss this as a piece of pop cultural trash. Like this is seriously a real film achievement
for sure. I think that there is some of the talking to the Academy happening. I think a sort of debate among the group, and I'm sure this is true of other critics groups as well, but, you know, New York Film Critics Circle is the oldest in the country, is like, we don't want to serve as Oscar predictors. You know, we want it to be its own thing. So as much as we might be gesturing towards someone like Regina Hall or Jennifer Lopez or Adam Sandler or Cameron Diaz and being like, hey, like, it is possible for people with performances like these to win awards, I hope we don't think of it as in a directly instructive way. You know,
but is that also a reason why you would avoid giving it to Renee?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. That's like actually kind of a handicap for her.
Right.
But she'll get it in the Globes and all the other things.
Sure. And presumably. Yeah, SAGs, presumably. Yeah.
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 I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, well, Richard, while we're on the critical beat, we wanted to talk about both the list that you and Cam and Sonia published last week of the best films and TV shows of the decade, and then this week, the best of the year. You don't have to speak for Cam and Sonia, but we have critics list for all three of you. How was the process of putting together your list, though?
You know, it's funny. It was something, I feel like we had a meeting about it, and Cam said something about, like, oh, it's all just made up. And I was like, you know what? That's true. It was sort of freeing to think of it in those terms. So I just went through every movie, you know, at, like, pages and pages of movies released in the 2010s, and I just winnowed it down to like the 10 that kind of struck me in that moment, and I wrote the list, and then I just let it be what it is, you know, because like it was never going to be correct. There's no way to do that, especially for something as expansive as a 10-year, you know, range of movies. But I'm happy with the choices. I mean, my number one was Mad Max Fury Road. I sort of always knew that was going to be the case all year, because I think it is the movie of the decade, if not the new century. I was happy to put some kind of smaller things like Princess Sid, a really tiny movie out of Chicago that is on Netflix that everyone should watch.
I saw that the director of that tweeted it, which must have been pretty...
He always seems very surprised that people have even seen his movie, let alone liked it. So it's good that he's staying humble, I guess. But, you know, there were a lot of things I had to leave off, which is why I was glad that there was Cam, you know, kind of doing his own list of 30 movies of the decade, which was a much bigger undertaking than my 10. So I think they're a nice complement to each other. And then we also had a similar thing for Best of the Year. I think we have Best of 2019. I don't think we have any overlap on our lists, or if we do, it's only one or two movies.
I think you both have Uncut Gems.
Okay, that's right. That's the one. Yeah.
I think that's the only one.
Yeah. But, you know, he put Once Upon a Time on Hollywood on his. I didn't put that on mine, and I had Hustlers on mine. I think it was a nice kind of dialogue with each other. And then you have Sonia doing TV, which, like, I don't know how anyone ranks TV at this point because there are, you know, so many shows, but she seemed to have winnowed it down to, like, a really thoughtful list.
Yeah, Sonia figures out a way to, like, rank the other two alongside Chernobyl, which, like, could not possibly be more different. Yeah.
Well, it's the two reactors, the other two reactors, right? Yeah.
I love seeing Melancholia on here. I remember seeing that at Toronto and walking out, like, just in a daze, just like, what was that?
Yeah, exactly. You know? And I think that's kind of the mindset I was going by when doing the list. It was not necessarily my favorite, like the things I would watch over and over again on a hungover Sunday or something. I wouldn't do that for Melancholia, certainly. But there's just nothing else like that movie that existed for in these 10 years. And it stuck with me since I saw it on a couch in my apartment on the Lower East Side in 2011 or whatever. And I just can't stop thinking about that movie 8 years later. So how could that not?
Right, even The Phantom Thread, which I actually did not like at all when I first saw it, and then I watched it again with my wife and was like, okay, this is actually really good.
And then you stopped eating the omelet she had made you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But then you just keep thinking about that film. You know, it comes up because it's haunting in that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a great list.
Thank you.
Yeah, can I ask you about one title on your best of the year list? Because Atlantics, Mati Diop's movie, I think I'm pronouncing her name right. It's on Netflix now. It's one of the you know, many Netflix releases this fall. And like, I know about it because it was at Cannes and I had a profile for it, but I didn't really have a good sense of it. So do you want to just give an endorsement for that since so many people can watch it now?
Yeah, that is a movie that was at Cannes. I believe that Diop was the first Black woman to have a film in the main competition at Cannes, which is sort of galling that that took that long.
Really?
It's wild.
But yeah, she is French Senegalese. Her father is a big Senegalese musician. Her uncle was a filmmaker from Senegal. And so she sets her film in Dakar. And it's basically what I really loved about Atlantics and I found so fascinating is that it's about the current, you know, wave of migration happening from West Africa, North Africa, the Middle East into Europe. But it's really about the people who get left behind by that. And we see a lot of movies about usually, you know, young men arriving in, you know, Berlin or Paris or wherever and experiencing that. And those are important stories to be told for sure. But I really appreciated that Atlantics turns around and looks at the people in Senegal who are like, well, we're all our young men just left, you know. And I think it's really fascinating. There's a really righteous kind of economic anger in the film. It's kind of a ghost movie, which is really kind of unexpected and cool. It's much more of a genre movie than I thought. I thought it was going to be a sort of, you know, social issues drama. And it is that. But it has this added element to it that I think is really fascinating. So, you know, that's the kind of opportunity you have when putting together a list like this, that hopefully it's a movie that if people haven't heard of it, they will seek it out. And, you know, thank you to Netflix for making it so widely available.
Yeah, and I believe it's going to be Senegal's submission for the Best Foreign Language Film Oscar, which I keep getting confused because France has this and Les Miserables and Portrait of a Lady on Fire. But this movie is, I guess, is a Senegalese co-production, so it's eligible, whereas they didn't submit Portrait of a Lady on Fire. Just keeping track of which films are actually going to be eligible for the Oscars this year for foreign language is really hard.
Yeah, yeah, because it's not about the language it's in. I mean, it's not. I mean, the movie is not in French, but it has a lot of ties. It has a lot of ties to France, exactly. So, yeah, it's kind of a complicated thing, but it's a really worthy movie. It won a prize at Cannes, justifiably, and yeah. So I hope people seek it out, and you know, it certainly stoked my curiosity to see more films made about this topic and made, you know, in West Africa.
Okay, back to some of the big kahuna movies that are starting to surface for us now. So when we talked last week, Richard had seen 1917. His review had just gone up. Now we've all seen 1917. It kind of is one of those movies that was lying in wait for a long time and then popped up everywhere and we all got a chance to see it. And I think we might be the 1917 fan club around here. I think we're all really crazy about it, right?
I'm obsessed with it. I love it. It like shot up to my like top. It's in my like top five, maybe top three of the year. I loved this movie. I absolutely adored it. So, yeah.
I might be the least, you know, I liked it. I thought it was good. Part of me thinks it's a little overly impressed with a innovation or whatever you want to call it, a gimmick that is kind of basically the same as like every first person shooter of the last like 25 years. It's basically like a video game.
There was one moment where like the gun was sitting out and I was like, oh, this is very video game. But then like it goes back. I don't know. There's like part of it. The gimmick or whatever, right, is the which we talked about is this seeming one shotness of the film, which, of course, is like digitally sewn together. But the way in which it makes you stick with this one character and stick with this horror as he's processing it, I don't know, it worked for me. I went in really skeptical. I was like, okay, give me your quote-unquote one-shot movie, Sam, it is. And then I was like, oh, no, this is really effective. So it worked on me, but well, I hear you.
And Mike, you should also, I mean, you're loyal to the Kaiser Wilhelm, so you don't like this movie about
I don't. Well, I thought it was propagandist.
Yeah.
And I'm going on Seb Gorka's podcast to talk about it later today, actually. I feel like the first somebody, I think Matt Patches wrote saying, you know, it's a noble failure and it's sort of technique ultimately betrays the story, which I didn't feel that strongly about it. But toward the late middle, I was starting to kind of be like, okay, I don't know. It works, but it felt like maybe the story ends up, it does get a little bit of a short shrift after a while because you are kind of stuck in the format. But that said, it's gorgeous. Really great performances by actors that I was not familiar with before. And it definitely, I think, more than any other World War I movie I can think of, gives you that sense of being in the trenches. I mean, any movie since Kubrick's Paths of Glory, right? I mean, it has that kind of like you are there in this hell. Yeah. So I thought it was, you know, I thought it was very good, but I just wasn't kind of like fully rapturous, I guess. So I wanted to point that out.
Yeah, I got the I felt like the story really lasted within the style because so much of the point of the movie is like how to endure, how to like find your way through this hell, how to be a human being amid all of this. Like, all of the brief moments where he gets to like, you know, talk to a baby or have a fun conversation with his friend or like, you know, they talk about their childhood. Like they stand out so much because of all the awfulness going on around them. And I feel like the presence of the famous people, which I know a lot of people say is distracting, and like, it's not distracting. Like you don't not notice that that's Andrew Scott or Colin Firth or Benedict Cumberbatch or whatever. But just like letting them kind of pop up and being like, oh yeah, hey, here's a person who I know. Here's like this thing that would be light in other circumstances. I feel like the world, this nightmarish world, was so effectively realized that all the little like bits of light within it or a celebrity or whatever really stood out for me, and it made you kind of like appreciate the cherry blossoms falling or the, you know, a baby looking at him or anything like that. It got me sucked into that world.
You mentioned the famous people, and Mark Strong has that line, I know you already know this, but it wouldn't do to dwell on it. And the whole movie really is just like a one giant stiff upper lip. It's just how much can you endure without complaining too much?
Yeah, basically.
The way that they found to light the nighttime is some of the most beautiful like filmmaking I think I've seen in a long time. I don't know why I was so taken with this movie. I can't really fully explain it. I will say this, it passes, so I've been watching all these screeners at home. We have a really nice TV. A lot of people wanted me to see this in the theater. I think you should see this in the theater. I think it is a gorgeous film, and I probably should have seen it in the theater, but I watched it at home. And my roommate is very uninterested in award screeners, and she just like will never sit down, and she does not care that we have access to all these movies. She's like the height of doesn't care. She got so sucked into 1917. She sat down, she got emotional. I was like, this is a powerful like piece of filmmaking, I think. So I don't know, in our house it was a big deal. And yeah, the celebrity cameos didn't bother me, except I think the only one that stuck out to me was Cumberbatch, and I was like, I don't know how I feel about this, but the other ones didn't flap me at all.
Well, I think Cumberbatch has become such a cameo unto himself. Like anytime he's in something, it's like, oh, it's a kind of a little winky joke that it's Benedict Cumberbatch.
Well, and his arrival is so like he is the person who he's trying to reach, basically. So when you get to him, it's like it's been built up where you're like, all right, who's he gonna be?
Yeah, no, I would say anecdotally, in terms of like interest in the movie, kind of similar to your experience, Joanna, is that like that was the one screener that my family was really disappointed I didn't have over Thanksgiving. They were like, what about that one? Yeah. And I was like, oh, no, don't have it. I do have it now. But like, so maybe Christmas I'll come home, you know, the triumphant person. But yeah, like there, I don't know. I think that movie will be appealing to a lot of people in a way that maybe something smaller, you know, wouldn't be. So I think that despite mixed reaction to it so far, I think that thing has got a lot of awards juice in it.
One prediction I'm ready to make right now is Roger Deakins will win for cinematography. Because I went to this Academy screening that was kind of like a Crafts Academy crowd. And partly because the actors are not as well known, but the first time I've ever been at a screening where the cinematographer got the biggest round of applause, both at the beginning when Sam Mendes was introducing everybody, and at the end when his name came on screen. Yeah. It was just like, okay, people like the cinematography, but it is sort of a gaudy show of expertise and prowess and, you know, all the rest of it. So, I mean, and ambition. So I think that that's pretty much a slam dunk at this
point.
And
he finally won his Oscar, right?
Yeah, he won for Blade Runner, the classic we all remember, Blade Runner 2049.
So it would be kind of funny if after like this like Susan Lucci run of not winning, that the dam is just now broken and Roger Deakins just wins every year.
I think I could easily see that happening. Yeah.
Well, that was kind of what happened with Lebesgue, because Children of Men was such a like a phenomenon, and it got just totally ignored by the Oscars. And then he won three in a row. Like he kind of had that, broke that streak the same way.
I think that I like can't argue, Mike, with you calling it gaudy. I completely agree. It's very flashy, but it serves the emotional journey in a way that like doesn't make it just seem like, oh, you're showing off what you can do with like camera tricks and lighting. I just, and you know, a lot of that comes down to performance. And so, you know, I just want to gush about this movie because I'm going to be like the sour apple about the next movie. So I just want everyone to know I love cinema.
And films about men.
Yes, films about men.
but no, I do think, just going back to Katie, something you said earlier, and without spoiling this movie any more than we already have, you know, it is the scene where he meets a baby where I was starting to be like, I'm not sure that I'm really buying the scenario here. Uh-huh. Like, I get that you had to do something, but some things start to feel like a stretch within the confines mm-hmm. of the
concept.
Yeah. The concept.
Universal has sort of limply offered up that actress is a supporting actor contender. Supporting actress
she
contender.
She has more lines than Anna Paquin. So,
she does. She actually, I think, technically does have more lines. Like, someone was like, okay, when comparing Irishman to 1917, and I did get someone on Twitter was like, you don't like the Irishman because it's all about men. I'm like, okay. But someone was like, wait, she was just praising 1917. I was like, yeah, but I think the woman in 1917 has more lines, if I'm being honest with you. Yeah, it's interesting, and like I you know, we haven't even said, Richard did when we first talked about this movie, we haven't even said the name George MacKay. George MacKay is like the anchor performance of this film.
Yes,
I think that he should be considered for his performance in this, and you know, having to carry a camera on you for the entirety of a movie is no mean feat, and he just does an incredible job, both with a stiff upper lip and then maybe with a not so stiff upper lip.
But
so,
for a minute, I really thought you meant that he was like doing some of the cinematography. I was like, wait, what? He wasn't carrying a camera.
He might have at one point. Probably, we don't know.
Yeah,
anyway.
Who knows in that movie?
But I mean, look, if you had been through a really hard thing and then at the end you saw Richard Madden, you'd cry too.
I cried and I just was like sitting there on the couch, so I don't know, you know.
Oh, Richard Madden. That is a stiff upper lip.
Beautiful hair.
Wow-wee.
Yeah.
Yes. No, George MacKay is very, very good. I agree with you. I think he should really be in the mix. And if he's not, it's only because people won't remember his name.
Right.
So let's say it one more time. George MacKay.
Well, also the best actor field is like so monstrous this year that it's so like it's hard for anybody to get in there.
And if any Universal Awards consultants are listening to this at like 3x speed because they're forced to, let me just say, make everyone learn George MacKay's name.
And Mike, he's in your favorite movie, Captain Fantastic. So you were—you can say you were on the bandwagon.
I was
really
early too. I did not know his name then, but yes, come on.
One thing I wanted to mention quickly about George MacKay is that one of his in-development projects is a music biopic about the Kinks. So, like, maybe that's his Oscar movie. I don't know. Like, yeah. those movies always do well for young actors, it seems.
Will he play Ray Davies, or do we know?
I believe so, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. He's Davy Davies, sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, but so we won't talk about Irishman, but just keep thinking about 1917 busting out here and then Once Upon a Time in Hollywood being a big contender. It is such a macho Oscar year. I think an interesting one. Like, I think there have been much more boring macho movies, like Hacksaw Ridge was a Best Picture nominee not that long ago. But really male, like a lot of about the decline of the mid-century white man and all the things that means, which I find intriguing, but I also can get if some people are going to get exhausted, which maybe we all be by February.
Ever wanted to go inside the Met Gala? I'm Cho Minardi, and this week on the Run Through with Vogue, we take you inside the world's most exclusive and glamorous party. We'll talk about the best looks from the red carpet and everything that happened after. Listen to the Run Through with Vogue wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, we've been promising to talk about The Irishman. It is on Netflix. It seems popular. It's impossible to know how many people are watching it or especially watching the whole thing. But like there's Irishman memes, which I didn't necessarily see coming before Thanksgiving weekend. Mike, I think you tweeted that you were rewatching it last night. So you might be the first person to watch The Irishman twice.
I have spent 6.5. I did not finish it. But I watched, because I watched it, I admit, I confess, I watched it on my phone on a plane.
Gasp! I'm going to kill Marty.
I'm sorry, Marty, but it was actually fine.
He and just stopped the 3x speed thing. Closed his podcast app.
And then I watched it again at home with my wife. And so I spent 6.5 hours in the last 48 hours watching The Irishman. But actually, it was great to watch it again. I actually kind of reconsidered something that I was theorizing on Twitter yesterday. The first time through, I kind of thought it was a story about a sociopath pleaser, which is a dangerous type, you know, that De Niro's character is incapable of feeling, but he kind of, in order to steer himself correctly, he just makes sure that he is loyal to somebody and they kind of tell him what's right and wrong. And unfortunately, that means that he gets told that he's right when he like murders people for a living. But the second time through, I was kind of questioning that. I think actually it is a very felt performance. It's not stiff upper lip. It's like emotionally strangled. I'm familiar with this being an Irish American man.
An Irish man.
You know, emotionally strangled mid-century man. And that makes it even sadder. You know, you just think this guy does want to be a good person and he does care about people in his life. And he's just really mixed up in terms of his, you know, whatever you want to call it, values and morality. But you can kind of see why. So I found it incredibly fascinating. And honestly, all the de-aging and everything made me really, really interested in De Niro just as like a figure, as an artist, as a person who's just been around for a long time. I think the biggest problem with the de-aging that's an interesting, maybe unanticipated one is we know what De Niro and Pacino and Pesci all looked like 20 years ago, and they looked nothing like this. Whereas when you age someone, you have no way of knowing what they're going to look like in 30 years. You can go back and look, but who cares at that point? So it is kind of uncanny. But then my friend Brendan McDonald pointed out on Twitter, like, that also makes it interesting because this character is not De Niro, it's Frank. When you go back 20 years, you know, De Niro wasn't a lumbering sort of slab of ham, you know, when he was 40, or at least when he was 30. So I don't know. I found it incredibly interesting. Like, lots of problems. I mean, Pacino's just like overacting out the wazoo, but
sort of in a great, fun way.
Like, how can you? It's not a problem. It's just a fact, right? You're just like the scene where he's like screaming at everybody, calling them motherfuckers. I mean, it's just like, it's so extreme, but it's wonderful. I feel blessed that we have this man to chew scenery the way that he does. And I don't know. But we got to talk about the women thing. Obviously, it's something, I'm not sure how intentional it was on the second time through. I'm a little worried it's not that intentional.
I want Joanna to talk about this because we've already had some of this conversation. I totally bought the way that it's intentional. And there's been a couple people already writing about Anna Paquin specifically, who is so notably silent. Like, she really only has 7 lines, but she's in a bunch of other scenes not saying anything.
I mean, that's clearly intentional. The Anna Paquin,
like, she's
part of
there
it.
As the silent witness. But I think that also added with, you know, there's this road trip that's the frame story, kind of within the frame story. And they have all these shots of the wives kind of chatting off camera in the distance, like with no one really paying attention to what they're saying, and you don't even hear the dialogue. I just think that the women are present in this movie but silent in a way that feels really specific, where women had no role in the society that these men had built up. You're seeing how toxic this society was. You kind of wonder, maybe if they'd let women do a thing or two, they wouldn't have turned out quite so badly.
But so on the other hand, they do stuff. And Pesci's wife, you know, we find that she's like mob royalty. And she actually, there's like one scene where you see her doing something, which is covering up for a crime. This is early on. It's not a big spoiler or anything. It's a really interesting scene. That made me wonder, like, how much of it was a choice? Were they really, they weren't pushed totally into the background. They were pushed like 85% into the background.
Yeah, and they were pushed by Frank specifically. Like, he kind of swaps out one wife for another and pays as little attention to either of them, even though they continue to kind of show up in scenes and you see their presence in his life. And I think Hoffa's wife, too, is a make to your point, Mike, where you see her, like, he's praising her as having some, you know, she's advising him and he kind of praises her as the brains behind the operation. And then you see a shot where she's getting in a car that she wonders if it might be bombed. And there's this really big moment of tension. So I get that, like, it's not this, like, complete, all the women are sidelined, and it's a commentary all the way through. But I did feel like, especially with Anna Paquin's presence, like it is there to remind you of how silent they were forced to be. And of course, her silence is what eventually like devastates her father, because she's watching and knowing what he is and not speaking to him for it.
Yeah.
But Joanna, you gave this all a hearty eye roll, which I do not think is unwarranted, because women are silent on screen so much that to say you're doing it intentionally doesn't necessarily get you off the hook. So do you want to talk more about that?
I mean, let me preface by saying, I am glad that this movie exists, and I'm glad that everyone is so excited to talk about it. Like, that's fun. It's fun that everyone's, like, talking about this, you know, film. It did not work for me emotionally. I did not find an emotional way into this movie, and because of that, like, it just didn't work for me. But I will say, you know, to your point about, the women and the silence, that would work for me, but then the pivotal moment of the movie, I mean, we've been spoiling the movie throughout, so spoilers for
Jimmy Hoffa
Irishman,
dies.
I guess. The moment when you're really supposed to feel like this pain for De Niro's character comes, you know, as he feels the loss of his relationship with this Anna Paquin character, who we just don't know at all, who is just a complete cipher to us. And that, then I can't feel that for him, because I'm like, I don't even know who she is. So I don't know what you're missing out on. And I don't feel this at all. Someone, I think it was Russ Fincher on Twitter, came back at me with like, I think that's intentional. It's like, it's supposed to be not, you know, him not knowing, us not knowing her is him not knowing her and all this sort of stuff. And I'm like, sure, I can see that. Every argument everyone makes is convincing to me. I'm like, I hear you. I think you're all very smart about The Irishman. It just does not land for me. And then when I think about trying to do it again, I'm like, oh, I should watch it again and really just like try to see what everyone sees in it. And then I'm like, do I have 3.5 hours to do that right now? I don't. So, you know, like,
I gave up to do for your critics awards.
I know. I gave it my 3.5 hours. Maybe a couple of years from now, I'll give it another 3.5 hours, but I don't have that time to carve it out. And something I will say before I stop being like the lone dissenting voice on Irishman on this podcast is every single person, even if they love this movie, every single person that I've heard talk about it has also said it could lose about 40 something minutes.
Ooh,
and I'm like, oh,
no,
you know,
no.
Yes. That's,
yeah.
That's,
I actually don't know that I agree with that. I mean, I get it, but I actually, obviously, because I went back to watch it all over again the next day.
Sure.
But I kind of enjoy the fact. I mean, look, it's crazy. Like, there's one scene where they reference Joe Kennedy having a stroke, and then there's a shot of somebody in a wheelchair
on Florida,
like a deck in Florida at a sunset. And you just think that was minimally $20,000 for like 1 second of film. And that's the thing Martin Scorsese can do now with Netflix money. And I said that to my wife, like laughing. And she goes, yeah, but it's such a good shot, you know, and it's true. So you kind of have to like, but again, that's kind of meta. But like, I enjoy the fact that these guys are just, they can do whatever they want now. They've earned it.
Yeah, no, there's so many like large scale scenes of like a Hoffa rally or the big party for Frank that takes up like a big pivotal moment in the middle of the film, or they just had all these people and all these visual effects on top of all the de-aging. Like, you feel that money in there. And that's not really about the length of the movie, but there is just something about, he wants to lay out a story about time. He wants to show how all of these people like thrive and then all die eventually anyway. It then takes time to kind of to watch all these people and watch all of that happen. And I'm not sure that like every single minute of it is used, but I appreciated it. I wouldn't cut 40 minutes out of it. I wouldn't cut 10 minutes out.
To your point, Katie, the first time through, it was such an immersion in a world that the second time through, you know, 2 hours in, I was like, wow, I can't believe we're already at this point now.
Right. Yeah.
Like, I felt like it was a lifetime, the first one, in kind of a great way. Again, I was stuck on a plane all day, so I had nothing else to do. but I do think that that is kind of like part of the value of it, or the quality of it.
I kind of wonder, like, now that a lot of people have seen the movie over the holiday, certainly the discourse is lively on this one. My impression after the Thanksgiving weekend, when people first were able to put eyes on the movie, I kind of think it didn't fare that well. Like, I think it sort of seemed to have become like kind of more of a meme and like a joke in a way, that kind of the way that Joker did. I just didn't see a ton of like super serious discourse about the movie beyond the thing with Anna Paquin's character, you know? And and so I don't know, I wonder if like that, does that matter to the Academy? Are they not like, are they not on film Twitter or whatever? Like maybe so, probably so. But I don't know. I was expecting maybe a little bit more, I guess, like veneration of the movie once people had seen it. And I kind of saw more people making jokes about how long it was and, you know, stuff like that.
Or the maleness. I mean, I saw a lot of smart women be like, okay, 15 minutes in and I don't think I need to watch anymore.
And I don't mean to minimize that. That is serious discourse about the movie and it's a conversation well worth having. I just mean that, like, I didn't see a sort of wide-ranging conversation about the film. I saw either that take, which is, you know, a lot of interesting pieces about it, or jokes. And so I wonder if that, how that affects its like awards chances.
And the memification, we've talked about this before, but often that comes directly from Netflix. Netflix will create these memes as a way to raise awareness around, you know, they did this with Bird Box, like as a way to raise awareness around their release. And so if you like, we talked about this last year, I heard a bunch of people say, I'm just watching Bird Box so I can understand the memes. So if there's a bunch of people who are watching The Irishman just so they can understand the memes, that's a win for Netflix. So, you know, but to your point, Richard, it's not exactly, you know, highbrow discourse, but like I don't know how Martin Scorsese feels about that. Is he just like, whatever eyeballs on my film I'm excited about, or is he, you know, penning an op-ed in New York Times about it right now about like this wasn't meant to be a meme? I don't know.
I mean, I think if you're Netflix, you're happy to see people talking about it to the degree that they are, because I think that was a big, not a problem with Roma, but Roma didn't have this presence at all. There weren't memes about Roma. It wasn't fun to talk about. Like, you couldn't like make a joke about one of the lines from it. I mean, I'm looking at the Netflix Twitter account and their bio just is late and wearing shorts, which is a really funny Irishman joke, I think. So and the same thing with Joker. Like, Joker had discourse, had a bunch of memes about it, but people just kept talking about it, and it made $1 billion. And I think, yes, the Academy voters aren't on film Twitter, but also they're just like, it's going to be at the top of your mind, and then you get to go kind of go watch it, hopefully.
Yeah, and really, what are movies but long GIFs, you know? So.
Wow. With sound gifts.
Oh, sound. Damn it. That's right. Of course. They have sound.
Before we wrap Irishman, we may be talking about it yet for months, but I just wanted to throw out something that that Chris Rosen tweeted, where he said, at this point, I feel like a surprise nomination for Anna Paquin could be possible. Which I don't know is entirely serious, but it does feel like the Irishman's like Oscar juggernaut status is very cemented by all of this.
Yeah, I could see that too. It's a joke, but it's also the kind of thing that could sort of happen, because as we were talking about, people would just say, well, we need to kind of protect Marty and let everyone know that this is not a sexist movie and or something. Do you know what I mean? Like, I could see it happen. Yeah. But I don't think there are many wonderful Anna Paquin performances. I don't know that this is like her best, but she did her job, you know. Yeah. I don't think like it's an act of violence on her that she's in this movie with seven lines. But I do think that I would say that the discussion of it is a good thing. And even the memeing of it means that people care. People are talking about it. It's a thing. I think Marty was, if I may call him Marty, was actually very shrewd to kind of start this or continue, once it started, this kind of cinema conversation. It's almost it's like an implicit comeback to the idea that, this is pretty boring. I heard some people complaining on Twitter, saw some people complaining that it's boring. I didn't find it boring at all. But there's kind of like, it's almost implied that you're a bit of a vulgarian if you are going to say it's boring and you only like comic book movies or something like that, you know? So I think that it's very well positioned to play a very big role in award season. And how about, I just like, the performances are amazing, but I feel like Joe Pesci, I never really thought that much about Joe Pesci, to be perfectly honest. Obviously, he's amazing in Goodfellas, and then we all love, like, My Cousin Vinny, and then after that, you know, but even then, in both
Mike,
of those, he was kind of like a clown.
I know you're not the demographic for Home Alone, but Home Alone.
Well, okay, Home Alone, right, sure. But in all of these, he's kind of a clown, and in this one, he's not a clown.
It's a quiet.
And it's an incredibly strong performance.
Thoughtful. Yeah, no, I agree. I think he's my favorite performance in the film. You know,
it's haunting and haunting and almost disturbing.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I mean, and that's a category. I mean, I, who did not like The Irishman very much, really liked Pesci, especially in the very end of the movie. I thought his performance was incredible. And that's a category. I mean, is that Brad Pitt's category? Like, is that a category that is open for discussion? I think they're running Pacino in that category as well. Yeah. So, I don't know what to tell you, but I you know, Pesci in there, it makes me really excited and happy, and I would love to just see him. I don't know, what's a Pesci Awards campaign like? Is it going to be like a fun,
it's
like
nothing? It's him refusing to do absolutely any promotion. Oh. Which is I think at the New York Film Festival someone asked him a question and he just said no in response and didn't talk anymore, and as far as I know has had no interest in doing promo whatsoever. I still think he's going to get nominated, but I think he's going to be fine, if you want to nominate me, I'm not doing the work.
Okay, so anti Richard E. Grant, whatever Richard E. yeah. Grant is, the opposite of that.
Yeah,
okay.
And then he's gonna get the nomination anyway, which maybe proves his greatness.
He should, though. I mean, I think Pacino. Look, it's a lot of fun. His accent, I don't know what's going on, but points for effort, A for effort. I'm trying to do a Midwestern accent, at the end of the day, Pesci. That's the performance where it really gets under your skin, I think. I mean, De Niro is kind of doing something incredible. Anyway, it's different. It's a lead, but Pesci, I think, is to me. I just never thought that much about him as an actor. I thought he was he's good. He's fun. Do I amuse you? All that. It's great. But not in this one.
Yeah. I think Pesci getting nominated would indicate a sort of, I don't know, wider embrace of this movie that comes fraught with, certain issues, whether it's, women's roles in the film, the Netflix of it all, but I think there's enough there that a certain strain of Academy voter, Hollywood type will embrace because it's an old movie, It's like, God damn it. Yeah, we're Hollywood. We're going to make a 3.5-hour movie. We're going to put these old guys in it who we've been loving for 40 plus years. It's going to be about the mob. It's, it's very defiantly not a contemporary movie, despite its technology, despite its, its distributor. And I don't know. I feel like that's a narrative people can get behind. What I would be interested in seeing is does weirdly Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which is literally about some of that stuff, eat into Irishman's support or vice versa,
Well, they're going to also have the ability to do a pretty compelling sort of it's time career capper, because they're already talking about this as the fourth chapter in a story that began with Mean Streets and continues with Goodfellas and then Casino. So you can sort of get that kind of last sequel of Lord of the Rings type Oscar campaign.
What?
Yeah.
This is Scorsese's Return to the King. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, for real.
I think it's his Hobbit trilogy. That's what I think.
I mean, they are both pretty short. All three of them, actually. Yeah.
I mean, it would be interesting, and who knows, maybe this is still a little women's role to play, but if you've got these two, mid-century men looking back at what they've done in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and The Irishman, and something splits the difference and kind of goes through the huge, other lanes next to that. But I don't know that anything is positioned for that yet.
But do you know what I mean when I say that, I feel like the same kind of people will will appreciate those movies? The same kind of voter, I guess.
But if I had to say, if I had to make a prediction as Gen X person, they will go with the boomer one.
Yeah.
The Gen X one will lose.
Right.
No one cares about us. We don't have enough people.
Sorry, who's speaking? I don't. Anna Paquin, is that you?
Oh, well, now for the back half of the episode, we're going to have Joanna's interview with Kristen Anderson Lopez and Robert Lopez, writers of The Many Earworms of Frozen 2 that I cannot get out of my head personally. How was your conversation with them, Joanna?
Oh, it was really fun. There's a lot of singing in this interview, which I didn't expect. I kind of love anytime someone you're interviewing breaks into song. And they talked about some of the sort of surprising inspirations behind these songs. Katie, you had this great tweet over the weekend about how you walked out of Frozen 2 being I don't know if any of these songs are catchy. And then now you're I live with a kid and I listen to the soundtrack and I got a screener and I can't.
It's just part of my life now.
I keep listening to the soundtrack because I had the same same reaction. I was like, I don't know that this is as catchy. And then I was like, oh, wait, it definitely is. So, here are Kristen and Bobby to talk about. And they, like, by the way, they are huge. We don't talk enough about, like, this is a double EGOT. Robert Lopez is a double EGOT winner. Like, this is Little Gold Men prime.
He has all the Little Gold Men there are.
Yes. So, please enjoy this conversation with the Lopezes.
All right. So I want to start by asking you about my favorite, most surprising song of the movie, which is the Christoph, like, 80s power ballad song. And I was just talking to Jonathan Groff, and he was saying, I didn't know how they would get a mountain man like Christoph to sing in this film. So what was putting that song together like for you?
Oh, that was the most fun. We had the best time writing it. And everything really comes out of story, and we're so inspired by the stories that Jennifer Lee and Chris Buck, you know, bring to us and say, let's flesh this out. How can we get Christoph singing? We had originally written a song for Christoph called Get This Right, which was about him putting this huge amount of pressure on himself, and it was totally a comedy song, but it kind of fell on the ground because we... for many reasons. So then we found this other moment where he's been trying and trying and trying, and he's just been left in the woods. And we thought this was this great moment for him to feel his feelings in a real way, and that there's nothing better than a man feeling his feelings in a real way at a bar, like a karaoke bar, when you see those guys being like, we're in heaven, oh yeah. And we thought maybe that would be this way to have fun, but also really feel the depth of his love for Anna.
Yeah, and I think we just lived for a moment. We had never done this before, but where the distorted guitars kick in. I mean, come on, that is the quintessential moment of the 80s, and it just seemed to be perfect for Christoph.
One of the things we had to do was give permission to go to this stylized place, which is where the reindeers are better than people reprise was really helpful, because it gave us this ramp that allowed us to go into fantasy for a second, that allowed the animators, who basically there was like one little note at the top of our lyric that said, feel free to take this to an 80s video kind of place.
they felt quite free. I remember, they got this idea that Sven would actually move his mouth and say those words, and I think that's the moment where we started to realize, like, oh, this is going to go off the rails in kind of a great way. What's so great is when we give a song to Disney, it's not necessarily in its finished form. Sometimes they say, great, we're going to run with this for a little while and then we'll get back to you. And so they did with this, and they said, we had told them, let us know if you want us to add some harmonies to this song. There were no harmonies yet. And they said, we're thinking maybe lots of reindeer singing harmonies.
So that allowed us to go to that stacked Queen meets Chicago kind of place, which was so much fun. And Bobby laid down like 18 different tracks, and then Jonathan Groff did them 18 times. So not only is this a solo for Jonathan Groff, but it's actually 18 Jonathan Groffs to try and make up for the fact that we are ashamed and will be for the rest of our lives that he didn't sing in Frozen 1,
in the first one,
other than that ditty.
You're like, can this be the end of that now? Never come with, we gave you 18 Groffs. He said that before he started recording, you guys showed him some videos on YouTube of like inspiration. Do you remember what that was?
I think we just went down the 80s power ballad rabbit hole. And here's the thing, I grew up totally loving those songs and living those songs, and when my 13-year-old boyfriend Sergio broke up with me, I was listening to Bryan Adams and Chicago and all of those people, and we really wanted to
honor. Dumped him. Sorry.
I think we did it. I dumped him, he dumped me. It was middle school. But we really wanted to honor the amazing thing that all of those musicians did, which was empower men to feel big feelings and express them. And something has been lost in the 30 years since then, where I don't I don't feel in a lot of male-driven rock songs that empowerment to just go full on emotional.
The culture has gotten a lot less sincere in 30 years.
Yeah.
Let's just say that.
Absolutely. To circle back to sort of the beginning of approaching this project, what are some of the particular challenges of writing a sequel musical, a musical that is a sequel to a project you've already done?
It's funny, we didn't even realize this until press time, but this is the first musical sequel Disney Animation ever did. So it was we were foraging new territory, and it was a little bit tricky because you would think, when you do a sequel, often you bring back musical themes, but we didn't want to retell old story beats. These songs are very tailored for story beats. And so what we thought of at first is maybe this is act two of a larger arced musical. So Frozen 1 is act one, Frozen 2 is act two. It's the same story, it's just the next chapter.
And luckily, we also had amazing collaborators in Chris Buck and Jennifer Lee. And they instantly said, we're not going to redo Frozen 1. We're going to go more mature, darker. We're going to maybe even go into a bit of a different genre, which they did. It's a mystery. This is it. There's still the DNA. It's still a musical. But these girls are seeking truth in a place of chaos and change. And it's a much more grown-up musical. And so we didn't have to worry about trying to do what we did before. All we had to do was trust our collaborators and get inspired by them.
And a lot has changed, even in just the short time between Frozen 1 and Frozen 2, both in stage musical theater and in movie musicals. I just think the popularity of something like your own stuff and then Hamilton and then La La Land and movie music, I feel like we're just in an upward swing of broader popularity of musical, like more receptivity to musicals. Does that change at all your approach in how you do things, or are you just same as it ever was?
When we were starting out, musicals were sort of lower on the totem pole of culture. And one of the great things in our life is I feel like we've seen that turn around, and people have embraced musicals in a new way. I think people are less resistant to characters breaking out into song, but you still have to do the work of making it not awkward and horrible, because there's nothing worse than when a character breaks into song for no good reason.
I was going to say that in this world where we're getting more and more digital and less connected, there's still something so human about singing. And I think, I have to believe that's what this resurgence of loving musicals is about, that when we're singing something that someone else is singing, it's a way we can connect in an authentic way, especially if we're all in the same place at the same time, like a movie musical or a Broadway musical where you're all experiencing it together. I think it's something that existed before humans even spoke, is song. And I think it might be the thing that saves us all from becoming robots.
One of my favorite things that you guys talked about in the first movie is the way that you snuck the villain song into a classic love song, right? You think you're watching, in the first one, you're watching a love song. It's the villain song.
Right. That's how ex-boyfriends work.
Right. are there any kind of subversions or unexpected musical surprises that people should be on the lookout for in Frozen 2?
One thing they can be inspired by is Olaf's song was really something we kind of wrote, because when you're in the middle of writing these original musicals, it does feel like you're trapped in a spooky enchanted forest that you can't get out of, because some of the things are working, but many things are not. And you kind of have to just say, okay, I'm going to trust the process. I'm going to trust my collaborators. I know there's a deadline, and I know we have a release, and 18 months from now, this will all make sense. 18 months from now, this will be a finished movie, and it'll be great. And I trust in that. And so inspired by that, I kind of got this idea for this will all make sense when I am older lyric for Olaf. But it was really sort of Everybody, it was a protest, and it was what everyone working on the film was feeling at the moment. Or even like 3 months from now, this won't be driving me so insane. 3 months from now, we'll at least have gotten to the screening.
Right.
It's another way of saying I have no idea what's going on.
Something that I loved that occurred to me watching, I went to a screening last night and the credits roll and everyone just sits there and gets to have basically a concert, like Panic at the Disco, Kacey Musgrove's Weezer concert, sitting in their seats just like rapt, what am I going to hear next? How do you make those choices? Are you involved in those choices?
We're involved, but it's really our partner and our invisible partner in all of this is this incredible guy named Tom McDougall. He's the first one that ever hears any of these songs. We write them and they have to go through him first before we even give them to the directors. And he's the one who says like, yeah, I like it. But Tom has unbelievable musical taste. Like he's just, and he knows everybody too. He knows all the rock stars. And he was the one who created this amazing thing. It was such a fun summer getting to produce with Panic at the Disco, Kacey Musgraves, and Weezer. Bobby played the keyboard for the Weezer, so now I just tell people, this is my husband, he's in Weezer.
And we got to meet Weezer at the premiere a few nights ago, and they said it was okay that I say that, so I am in Weezer.
You're in Weezer. The Weezer version blew my mind because it just sounds like a Weezer song. You guys wrote it. You guys wrote a Weezer song. That's like, it's incredible the way that came through.
We wrote our first Weezer song.
Oh, sure. First of many.
Yeah, I think we might do an album, and I'm not kidding.
Yeah, and similarly, Panic at the Disco. I was like, how is this not written for Panic at the Disco?
Oh, my gosh. You know? We couldn't believe it. We were lucky to be there that day when he was in the studio about to sing it. And he had told us, or someone had told us, that he was going to sing the song in Adina's key and sing those same high notes that Adina hits. And we were like, I don't think that's a great, do we have a backup plan? And he came in and just blew us all away. It was unbelievable. And the song is such a party in that version. I mean, it's...
And the guitar's doing the
riff.
Oh, my
God. Yeah. It's great.
And that's an amazing producer named Jake Sinclair, who did both the Weezer track and the Panic at the Disco. And then Kacey Musgraves is one of my secret favorite things.
So good.
I mean, I love her. I love her stuff. I'm really into her, the Golden Hour album right now. But the spell that she casts with her writing partner, it's very like Simon and Garfunkel meets mystical, and I'm very excited for the world to hear that one too.
Yeah, it was giving me very like Alison Krauss sort of.
I'm from North Carolina, so I have a love of the mountain music too.
Sure, it's beautiful. I wanted to ask you quickly about, there's a credit for Aurora as the voice, and so what was that choice? What was the choice around that? And then also, knowing that a musical riff you were going to write was going to be such an integral plot point of this film.
Into the Unknown is the I Want song of the show. Elsa is the central character this time. And we had written a plain vanilla I Want song where she was just singing about I Seek the Truth. It was called Seek the Truth. And it was a little on the nose and it was a little limp. It just sort of sat there. And we had more collaboration with Jen and Chris. As a result of that, realized that we would invent a voice that was reaching out to Elsa, and only she would hear it, and it was calling her away from everything that she knew and loved into this dangerous journey. So we figured that that voice would be musical, and that the new I Want song would be a duet with it. And so the voice wakes her up at 3 a.m., and what we decided that it would sing is this motif called Dies Irae. It's from a Gregorian chant, and it's all associated with death and danger. You can hear it in tons of movie scores over the years.
Yeah,
you heard
okay.
it.
Yeah,
and it's been used.
Yeah, it's the beginning.
Opera.
It's the beginning of The Shining.
It's, right. It's right. been used by composers for the centuries.
Right,
and so it is that. And then we really needed to use a real Norwegian who understood kooning, which is a shepherdess. And it's a way that shepherdesses used to call their cattle. Each herd had its own song that it would come to.
Oh, wow, yeah.
So it's calling Elsa like a catalyst is the movie. the Aurora is the quirkiest, most amazing human being. A quote from when we recorded her, one of the things she said is like, I think I have too many tutus on. I'm going to take two of them off. another thing was when she said, may I take a break to do a cartwheel? She was, if you get a chance to interview her, you need to. The other thing to say about Into the Unknown is that it mirrors the whole movie. So Into the Unknown is an octave. Do-do, Into the Unknown, stepping your toe outside the boundary that you know. Into the Unknown, you've just flown an 11th, which you're told not to do when you're writing music. But you've gone so far afield, and that's what's going to happen with Elsa.
Love it. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
Well, that does it for this week's show. Next week, we'll have the National Board of Review, the ever-elusive ones, and the New York Film Critics Circle Awards to talk about, and then also the Golden Globes. We're going to have an episode coming out on Monday after the Golden Globe nominations are announced, so the awards rush continues. We'll actually have two episodes next week, so you'll get that and a whole other one, because what a busy season it is. In the meantime, you can find us at vanityfair.com, writing about all these things. You can find Richard and Kim and Sonia's top tens of the decade and of the year, and lots of Irishman coverage, too. You can talk to us on Twitter at LittleGoldMen or on our own. I'm at Katie Rich, and Mike
_ Hogan,
and Richard
Rylaws,
and Joanna.
Joe wrote this.
This episode was edited and produced by Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for the most subtle Oscar campaign goes to Mike Hogan.
Make everyone learn George McKay's name.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the Reviews Director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.